go back to the book of Genesis, the covenant between Abraham and God. So the traditional location for that covenant is on top of Mount Hermon. There is a location, a traditional location of Brit Bein HaBetarim, the Bein HaBetarim covenant. I'm not saying we know for sure archaeologically this is what happened, but definitely that's the, by the way, that's the only traditional location. Normally when you have traditional locations, you have several because everyone wants to claim ownership on a site. In this case, this is the only traditional location for the Bein HaBetarim treatment or covenant between God and Abraham. Speaking of God and Abraham and the covenant, God had promised Abraham two main things, right? What are the two main things? To make out of his son, Isaac, a mighty nation, to be as many as the seas of the sand of the sea, right? And second, to give him the land of Canaan. When was the first promise actually fulfilled? Where was it? Where? So in Egypt, right? The sons of Jacob actually immigrated to Egypt. Joseph is already like a big shot in Egypt, right? He's like the finance minister. And then 410 years later, they're living already 600,000. So they became a nation not in Canaan, they became a nation in Egypt. And the second promise was fulfilled when what? Joshua brought them back into the land of Canaan, right? Crossed the Jordan River. So the covenant was given probably around here, but it was fulfilled in Egypt. And then the Exodus actually giving the land of Canaan back to the Israelites. And by the way, the area of that place is now a closed military zone. So in order to arrange a visit, by the way, it is possible, you need to arrange it with the army, and that based on the security situation, but there is a way to visit. If you come over and you really insist, you say, we want to go there. It's very, very special, by the way, very unique, because the view is just spectacular. There's a way to do it. We need to arrange it with the army. Sometimes we get approval and clearance, sometimes we don't. Most people don't go there. I mean, not even Israelis. It's just the hassle to get the permit is like, even though the army is very organized, you send, you know, an application, it's not like a, it's not the government bureaucracy that can take years. No, I've spent a short period of time in Mount Hermon when I was in the army. That was not my main region, but I've been to Lebanon a lot. I mean, not as a tourist. So in Israel, just for your general knowledge, in Israel, military service is mandatory. So everyone, men and women, have to serve in the army. Men for 3 years, women for 2 years. So when you get to the age of 18, you don't go to college, you go to the army. The country is calling you, you go, and actually you contribute. You don't get paid for those years. You get pocket money. Of course, the army takes care of all of your needs, uniform, food, toiletries. I mean, you don't really need to buy anything, but of course some pocket money is important. Today soldiers get away more than, let's say, in my time, because we're way more spoiled. Also, you know, kids today ask themselves more of what can I gain from my military service rather than what can I give. Saying that, I visited yesterday my nephew, who just joined the army about 2 months ago, and he joined a special force, volunteering of course. And he's now in his parachuting course, which is across the street, not across the street, but I mean next to my house. We live in a country. So we took a run with the dog to meet him, because Saturday they don't really do much, so they kind of rest, but he had to stay. And so you see this salt of the earth kind of youth who really like, you know, he started to get ready and prepare himself mentally and physically when he was 16. He started to go into like special training to make sure that mentally would be strong enough and physically to get into that special force, like an elite unit. So we have a percentage of youngsters who would do it willingly. We have a very chunk of youngsters who would go to the infantry and armored corps and everything. But you see I would say the discourse is actually, what can I gain from it? So of course, naturally, when you serve, you gain a lot. You know, skills of leadership, making decisions under stress and pressure, teamwork. Another thing that these are really great tools for life. At the age of 18, you don't really know it so much, but in retrospect, you appreciate it way more. But what they ask is if I go to, there's a unit named 8200, which is like intelligence unit. And today, cyber saver and all of this, that's actually the big thing. So they, let's go to computers, let's go to cyber. Because when I finish my military service in cyber, I'll be recruited by any company in the world for whatever contract I want. Because the military experience of the Israeli army has a great reputation all over the world. So this is like a bit of a change, but again, it doesn't mean that it's worse. I'm just saying even the battlefield is different, the army is different, the challenges are different, and definitely computers and cyber have become a major, major element in any future battlefield or even contemporary one. So even the army is kind of a bit different than it used to be in the past, but it's mandatory after today. Ultra-Orthodox in Israel, the very, very Orthodox Jews, we can discuss it later, but they have an exemption for military service. Means when they get to the age of 17, you're on your 12th grade if you go to school. I mean, it's mandatory to go to school, but if, let's say, you go to public school, or you don't go to very Orthodox ones, but you get your first call to the army, means you start the process of a full year. They profile you, they test you mentally, physically, intellectually, and you get your profile. Means you get a whole form profiling you based on your mental strength, intellectual one and physical one. And the army actually provides you with jobs to match your skills with the needs of the army. That's how it works. And then you prioritize. And the army will try to match your priorities with your skills and the needs of the army. So it's a long process. It takes a year before you even go to the army. You go through this process, and then you have all kind of exams and physical ones. If you want to go to any of the special forces or to Air Force Academy or Naval Academy, there are extra exams. But it takes a full year. So an ultra-Orthodox kid gets this first call. All he needs to do is to fill up a form saying my occupation is studying Torah, and then get automatic postponed of military service of 4 years. You do it twice at the age of 28 when you already have 8 kids, the army doesn't really need you. So basically it's an official exemption for military service. That's a huge debate in Israeli society, by the way. So this is one group of Israelis who do not serve in the army. The other group of Israelis who do not serve in the army would be the Israeli Arabs. You know, 21% of the Israeli society is what we call Israeli Arabs. When I'm saying an Arab, it's an ethnic origin, it's not a religion, right? So you can be a Muslim Arab, you can be a Christian Arab, you can be, not in Israel though, an Arab Jew. Because if you're Jew, you're Jewish by faith, and you were born, raised, and live in Damascus, Syria, for instance, you will be Arabic by your culture and mother tongue and everything around you, but you'll be Jewish by faith. So for most people, that's a surprise. That's like a shock. What? An Arab Jew? Yeah, there are Arab Jews who live in Iraq or live in Damascus, and Arabs. So when I'm saying Arabs, I mean vast majority in Israel would be Muslims, but of course there are Christians who are Arabs as well. We have Druze who are Arabs. So there are other Arabs who are not necessarily Muslims. So 21% of the population is Arab, and Israeli Arabs in general, I'm doing generalization here because there's some exceptions, do not serve in the Israeli army. And the reason is that potentially our enemies are going to be Arabs or the Arabs. You don't want to check the loyalty of Israeli Arabs in the battlefield. That might be too late. Especially with all the tensions we have, not necessarily within Israel, but within Israel and the West Bank. And of course the families on both sides. And so all of this, as long as the conflict is kind of alive and existed, Israeli Arabs do not serve in the Israeli army. Not based on that. I mean, not based on that. You know, look for instance, the Druze, D-R-U-Z-E. Druze is a religion. The Arabs, it's a religion by itself. Founded about 1,000 years ago in Egypt. And Druze, as minorities, and their minorities wherever they live in the world, they've actually realized that in order to survive as a minority, they better to be loyal to the people and governments they live with or live under. So Israel was born, 1948. The leaders of the Druze appealed to the new Israeli government and said, we want to join the army, we want to be equal citizens, we want to have obligations as well as privileges as any other citizen. And the Druze, as a society, at least the men, serve in the army. They have mandatory service. We have Bedouins in Israel who are Muslims and Arabs, and the majority of the men would volunteer to join the army. Unlike the Druze, which is mandatory by law, the Bedouins volunteer. Why? As long as a group, you don't have any national demands in Israel, you can be embraced by the Israeli society. Where's the problem? Marcus asked about tension. So when you have a national demand, when you actually have this national identity, and you would seek to have your own nation state together on top or instead of the state of Israel, that's where the tension starts and the distrust actually exists. So that's the reason why in general Israeli Arabs would not serve in the Israeli army, because they have this different identity, a national identity, to have their own nation kind of political entity. And again, we can argue instead of Israel, side by side with Israel, these are pretty much very individual. But so that's where the tensions actually come in. Look, if you can see backwards, you can see the region of Naftali very, very clearly. I know it's hard, but we're going to turn around. But if you look, you know what, look to the left, you see that town on top of that hill. That's a town named Al-Hiyam. It's already in Lebanon. Okay? Now, the visibility to the north is very clear, very nice. So that's across of the border into Lebanon. We're very close to the Lebanese border. If you look up, not now, but now again to the left, here you can see the ridge, and that village over there, that's also in Lebanon, named Markaba. So you can see how we're very, very close to what today is the Lebanese border. Of course, all of these kind of new borders, they're only from 1923. This is all part of the, I would say, evolution of the nation state, which is relatively new concept, that divided the territory into different nation states, in many cases completely unrelated, without any concern to the groups of religious groups, ethnic groups who lived on whatever side of those borders, because the superpowers of the time had actually drew those borderlines based on their own interest only, so nothing to do with the locals. That's the very beginning of understanding the geopolitics of the Middle East. We're staying in Israel. We're not crossing into any of the other countries, but just for general information, something that's completely strange and odd for Americans, there is no crossing for civilians between Israel in Lebanon or Israel in Syria. There's no terminals, there's no crossing, border crossing, it doesn't exist. So the only way is if you're a United Nations kind of a peacekeeper, so there is a gate to be opened especially for you, between Lebanon and Israel, or Lebanon or Syria and Israel, or for military purposes, you find a way to cross. But rather than this, for civilians, it's a completely sealed border. Syria and Lebanon, these are the two countries that we don't have any relationship with. Jordan, we signed a peace agreement in 1994, and therefore there's easy access to Jordan. Egypt, a peace agreement was signed in 1979 already, so we can go to Egypt. So these borders are open, but Lebanon and Syria, completely sealed. The question should be asked is, if you don't really need to seal the border. By the way, this kibbutz is called Dan, D-A-N. So you can imagine after the tribe of Dan, or the son of Jacob named Dan. If you look at the tribal division map, You can see that Dan originally got its land in the, I would say, the best location ever, which is where today is the area of Tel Aviv, prime real estate, at a time not so good, because there was border with the Philistines. Constant fight, right? So after a while, the Danites have had enough of it, and they said, we want to find a more kind of a tranquil area. They sent spies to explore the country, and someone told them, go up to Laish. Laish was the original Canaanite name of that Canaanite town over here. They came to Laish, they saw the people, the very well fortified city. They saw the people living by the tributary of the Jordan River. So it's a very fertile piece of land. And they lived, according to the Bible, in tranquility. And the Danites said, after so many years of constant fights, all we need is some tranquility. They brought the people up, took over the city of Laish, and named it after the forefather Dan. So Dan became actually the major city along that road, connected the Mediterranean Sea and Damascus. For centuries, it's been the major city. And by the way, the tributary of the Jordan River would be named Dan as well, till Caesarea Philippi took its place. So at one point, Panias, which was smaller, from the Greek period, of course, a way newer or later than Dan, was built. But only in the first century is Philippi rebuilt it entirely, named it Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi became the major city along that major road. And again, we always have to keep in mind, an importance of this of a city would not be because of its, I don't know, religious importance or anything like this, but because of its location. Whenever you have a road nearby, a major road, in this case connecting the Mediterranean Sea, the city of Tyre, which has always been a major port city, and the city of Damascus, which has always been a major political center, then sitting as a major city along that road becomes very, very important. So Caesarea Philippi replaced Dan. But Dan, originally, that's the main city along that road. If you think, do you know what's the Hebrew name for Jordan, Jordan River? How do you pronounce Jordan in Hebrew?
Yarden.
Yarden, which is also a name of a good wine. If you are fans of this side of the culinary, Yarden, remember the name. But if you split Yarden into two, it has Yarad, Dan, descends from the Dan. So all related to the name Dan. Here we go. Every day we need to learn something new. And here you can see this is like the very foothills, but we, in a way, starts to ascend toward the Golan Heights. We're not going to go the whole way up. Panas is really on the foothills, but already as part of the region of the Golan Heights means pre-1967, right now, we would be in Syria. So Panas, the place we're going to visit, pre-1967 was Syria.